A whole lot less if they're not all right. It's always the same damn no-win situation, he says. You can't get hold of a cop and finally instigate a search, then it turns out he's watching TV somewhere and eating a Big Mac, or he's gotten drunk at lunch and is screwing his girlfriend. We can only hope that's what it is. I look out at the rain, at the roll of yellow tape in the flower bed. You and me both. Marino's jaw muscles are flexing. Maybe one of them was securing the property when the skies opened up, and that's why only the front steps have tape across them and the roll was left where it is. Maybe the person got out of here in a hurry. This is a very bad storm. Yeah, it's bad. But something's not right. Marino makes the understatement of the year. First we think she's an obvious accident. Now she's a homicide, and we can't find a Range Rover, and I don't know where the hell my backup is. There should be two cruisers parked out here, keeping an eye on the place. Hold on a second. He tries another number. Hey, it's me again, back at the same address, he says to whoever answers. A female, I suspect, based on his flirty tone. Have any units been dispatched to the house here on Brattle since I left around 10:30 hours? Specifically, 237 and 110, anything from them? Units 237 and 110 are Hyde and Lappin, I presume. And Marino meets my eyes and shakes his head. Really? No contact at all? They haven't responded to any radio calls in almost 3 hours? And they haven't marked out of service or anything like that? Because that's screwed up. They were coming back here from Duncan. We're supposed to secure the perimeter and watch the place. Well, the point being, I need to talk to them, and I need to know who's been on the property since I left. Okay? Get back to me as fast as you can. I watch water boil on bricks. The billowing rain is almost horizontal. You could ping their phones, I suggest to him. That requires a warrant. Not the way I've seen you do it. Let me see what Helen finds out. I don't know who that is. The dispatcher I was just talking to. Me and her have gone out a few times. I'm glad you have helpful friends. We need assurance that Hyde and Lappin are safe. What I don't want is to get them in trouble, Doc. And I could. Big trouble if they're out of service without telling anyone, and we ping on their phones and figure out where they are, and it's not related to their jobs. I don't want any chance that they're unsafe, I repeat. You think I do? Don't take any risks, Marino. Not with her on the loose. I don't need to say Carrie Grethen's name. He knows who I mean. I get that. And don't think it's not entering my mind. But it's serious shit when you sound the alarm, and every cop in northeastern Massachusetts starts looking for someone. I'm not ready to do that yet, he says. There's not enough of a reason. Some cops are bad about the radio and don't always answer their phones or get back to you right away, and there could be a lot of reasons why. But you don't call out the troops unless you're sure, and I'm not. There's probably a good explanation. I'm sure there is, but don't assume it's good. Do we have reason to think someone else might have had access to the Range Rover? I ask. What about the housekeeper? Elsa Mulligan, I believe you said is her name. Is it possible she moved it for some reason? She'd better not have. Does she impress you as someone who might do something like that, based on what you've been told? Hyde talked to her for only a few minutes, and I didn't talk to him long when you and me first got there. But I remember he said right off she was really upset, and he told her to go home and we'd sit down with her later. He felt bad for her, probably because she's nice looking. I remember Marino in the kitchen with Hyde after we first got here early this morning. I couldn't hear what they were saying. I was in the foyer with the body. I was busy. He said she's nice looking. Nice body. Pretty face with funky short black hair and big dark framed glasses. He said she looked very Hollywood. I thought you said she's from New Jersey. It was Hyde's opinion that she looked Hollywood. That's what he said. Did she understand she wasn't to touch or disturb anything, or return here until you said it was all right? I then ask. What's the matter? You think I forgot how to do my job? He stares straight ahead as rain slaps the windshield. You know I don't think that. I made it clear to her not to touch anything or step foot here until I told her otherwise. He's busy with his phone again, his thumbs typing fast. That doesn't mean she obeyed your directive, I reply. Maybe there were items inside the house that she wanted to retrieve or tuck out of sight. Or she might have feared that once the mother gets here, there's no chance of getting back inside. People do all sorts of seemingly irrational or unwise things when there's a sudden death. Most of the time, they don't mean to make our jobs harder. They don't mean to cause trouble. Why do I feel like you're lecturing me right now? You feel that way because you're frustrated. You feel powerless, and that makes you angry and impatient. Understandably. It's not understandable, because I don't feel that way. I'm sure as hell not powerless. The other day at my gym, I deadlifted 350. That's not exactly powerless. Of course that's not what I'm talking about. I don't react to his rudeness and silly macho boasts. I have no question about how physically strong you are. This isn't about how much iron you can lift. I open my door, and the sound of splashing water is much louder. Chapter 30. Cold rain lashes my face and soaks my hair and clothes as I step out of the truck. My attention returns to the flower bed, to the roll of bright yellow tape. I head there automatically like a divining rod, and the wind rushing around the eaves makes a whistling howl that is unearthly and foreboding. I crouch down by the wooden bulkhead doors, painted the same dusky blue as the house, pitched at a steep angle and bordered in old bricks. Rain coldly smacks the top of my head and back. What feels like buckets of water splash around my soaked black nylon boots as I look around at broken purple asters, at brown-eyed Susans that have been flattened and bruised. My opinion doesn't change. Someone began securing the perimeter and got as far as the front railing and then stopped. For some reason, this person left the roll of tape in the flower bed next to the bulkhead doors. They're closed tightly, but I can't tell if they're locked. I contemplate my next move as the wind moans in a lower octave. I don't want to nudge or touch the doors with my boots or bare hands, and I pick up a branch snapped off by the storm. I hold it by its broken end, poking the tip through the steel handles. I try lifting. The doors don't budge. I shout this to Marino as he slogs toward me in the deluge. A key lock versus a padlock, I explain over the driving rain. Someone may have been using these doors to enter the lower area of the house. The flowers have been crushed and gouged as if someone was stepping on them. When you were in the basement earlier, did you notice if these doors might have been accessed recently? Nothing much down there and nothing caught my eye. He looms over me, his hands on his hips. Water streams down his shaved head, and his shoes are beginning to squish. If it was Hyde who came back here with the tape, what made him walk over here and step all over a bunch of flowers? It would seem that someone did. That much we can say. I return to the back of the truck, and the water is already inches deep in low-lying areas of the lawn and walkway. And then he got interrupted? Marino squishes and splashes after me. Now nobody can find him or his police car. As I've suggested, maybe you should ping his phone. I try the tailgate's double doors. They're locked, just as I thought they would be. I find the right key, and my fingers are wet and slick. I open up the back. Lights automatically blink on, and I smell the fresh citrus scents of the disinfectant and bleach we use to wash our transport vehicles. I mandate that we scrub and decontaminate them until they're clean enough to eat in, although I don't mean it literally. I scan for the source of the mysterious clanking. I don't see anything that could account for it. The diamond plate steel floor is empty and spotless, shining like a new dime. The scene cases, the storage chests and cabinets are tightly buttoned exactly as I left them. Fire extinguishers, chemical cabinets, and large tools such as rakes, shovels, an axe, and bolt cutters are bracketed to the sides. Nothing is loose. Not the laptops, not the camera and forensic light equipment, not the remote controls for the multiple flat-screen displays that constitute what I consider my mobile office. I have everything I need in here, including communication technology that allows me to work while away from the CFC for the better part of a day, as I am right now. I climb up on the tailgate slowly, awkwardly, careful with my leg, dripping water as I walk around inside, making a hollow thudding sound on the steel flooring. I search the rear area, where the noise seemed to be coming from while I was driving, my attention fixing on the built-in workstation and a swivel chair secured to the floor with fasteners. On top of the desk are a computer tower and flat panel monitors with tough polyurethane covers and screen protectors. On either side are watertight, rust-proof storage cabinets. I open the one on my right. Nothing unusual, just a printer in the pull-out tray and under it reams of paper. I pause for a moment when Marino's phone rings. It's the dispatcher, the one named Helen.
Okay, like we thought. That's too bad.
Nope.
Me too.
Still waiting, Marino says to her. If I don't hear anything soon, I'll let you know. Thanks again. His phone is in a waterproof tactical case that he clips to the waistband of his soaking wet cargo shorts. No luck, he says to me. No earlier radio traffic about any units responding here after you and me left mid-morning, and nothing about the Range Rover. If we don't get some sort of idea of what's happened to Lappin and Hyde, we'll put it out over the air. She's trying to raise them on the radio, and neither of them are answering, I summarize as I find what I'm looking for in the cabinet on my left. Another few minutes and nothing from them, and we pull the trigger. You might want to pull it now, I tell him. The polished copper rod is approximately 3 feet long and the thickness of a pencil. It rests against stacks of blue towels, and an alarm is sounding in a remote part of my brain. I notice a stiff yellowish fringe on one end and what looks like a claw of bent razor blades on the other. I bend down to get a better look and detect the acrid, pungent stench of decomposing flesh. I begin opening drawers until I find a box of gloves.
What is it?
Marino watches from outside the open tailgate as he's blasted by rain and wind.
What did you find?
Give me a minute. I put on gloves and a face shield. There's something here that certainly shouldn't be.
I'm coming up.
No, it's best you stay where you are. I print a label for the white plastic ruler I'll use as a scale, and I take photographs without touching or disturbing anything. Then I reach inside the cabinet and pick up an arrow that's unlike one I've ever seen before. It isn't functional. I can't imagine how it can be. What bow could fire a solid copper arrow that weighs as much as a pound? Were it even possible, what would be the reason? I hold it up in my gloved hands and inspect reddish-brown stains on the damaged three-bladed broadhead tip and the elaborately engraved polished shaft. I turn the arrow in my fingertips. The stench is from the fletching, which isn't made of feathers.
What the hell?
Marino is about to climb inside anyway, and I again tell him no. The back of this truck has just become part of a crime scene, I say to him. We're going to have to treat it like that at any rate.
What crime scene?
The look on his face is fierce.
Jesus Christ!
I don't know yet, I reply, as I watch it settle over him, one thing turning into another and going from ugly to unthinkable.
Copperhead.
He repeats the nickname that is stuck in the media, the nickname of a monster we know is Carrie.
Copper bullets, now a copper arrow.
The splashing, the constant drumming on the metal roof are very loud, and I have to yell when I explain that the arrow's broadhead tip is a mechanical game point,
It expands on contact, rather much the way a hollow-point bullet does. The goal is to inflict catastrophic injuries, to kill quickly, mercifully. Except, as you well know, bow hunting arrows typically are constructed of extremely lightweight carbon fiber, I add. The fletching or vanes meant to stabilize the arrow in flight are usually real feathers, occasionally synthetic, but not whatever this bristly material is. It's about an inch long, pale blonde, and toothbrush firm, as if it's been varnished. I find a hand lens and a flashlight to get a better look at what could be pieces of a pelt. Not animal, but human. And in bright light and magnification, I see dirt, fibers, and other debris, including granules of what looks like black sugar. I see remnants of glue, where the three thin strips of leathery backing have been attached to notches machined into the copper shaft. I think of mummified human scalps. And I have a strong suspicion about what this is as I cover a countertop with blue towels. I place the arrow on them. The razor-sharp broadhead has been deployed. The reddish-stained blades are bent backward, as if the arrow penetrated a target and was forcibly pulled out. Carrie has hurt or killed someone else. I can't possibly know this for a fact. Yet I have no doubt, and it's not coincidental that I can't conduct a simple and quick presumptive test for hemoglobin. Copper is an impossible problem, and very little is random with Carrie. I remember the way she used to look at me coldly and with calculation during our encounters at Quantico. No matter what I said about science, medicine, law, or anything at all, she always acted as if she were better informed on the subject. I felt she was judging me, looking for anything that might verify her superiority. She was competitive. She was jealous and impossibly arrogant. She was extraordinarily knowledgeable, charming when she chose to be, and one of the brightest people I've ever met. I know her patterns. I know them as well as she knows mine. She's creating situations, and then sabotaging any effort I might expend in response, and copper is part of her plan. I saw in the videos that she believes copper has healing, if not magical properties. She would also be aware that it creates chaos at crime scenes. The reagent, phenolphthalein, plus a drop or two of hydrogen peroxide, will instantly turn a swab bright pink no matter what chemical or material is present. In the typical presumptive blood test, copper tops the list of substances that react with a false positive. In other words, I'll definitely get a confirmation. It could be correct. It could be misleading. And that's Carrie's unique gift. She creates confusion, false hope, wrong turns, seeming impossibilities, and is supremely skilled at curdling one's deductive skills, of foiling science and procedures. She revels in upending our routines and training on their heads. And I feel as if she's inside the truck with me. I know without empirical proof that what I'm thinking will be validated soon enough. There's no point in denying that the disasters of the day all come from the same single source. Carrie has been here. She might be here right now for all we know, and I explain this to Marino as he waits in the downpour, standing there stoically because he has no place else to go unless he sits inside the cab. He won't. He'll wait. I feel him watching me cut and fold heavy white paper. He can't be as certain as I am because he hasn't seen the videos and doesn't know about them, but I can imagine his thoughts as I seal my package with red evidence tape that I initial and date. He stares mutely at me with his head bent in the heavy rain. His darkening mood is palpable. "Are you sure it couldn't have been in there for a while?" he finally asks. "Maybe from some other case, and it got left in there somehow. Or maybe it's a joke, someone's sick joke." "You're not serious." "As a heart attack." It's not from some other case, and it's certainly not a joke. At least not something a normal person would consider a joke. I dig into my pants pocket for the nitrile-cocooned metamaterial I found on Lucy's property. I'm grasping at straws because I don't want to believe it, he says. I don't want to believe it either, I agree. How the hell did it get inside the truck? I don't know, but that's where it was. And you're thinking it's her. What do you think, Marino? Jesus. How the hell could she get inside your truck? Let's start with that, one thing at a time. Someone put the arrow inside the cabinet to the left of the desk. It's a fact. It didn't get there on its own. That's what I can tell you without reservation. I label a plastic evidence bag with the time and location of when and where I found the tiny quartz-like hexagon that I tucked inside the finger of a glove. What are we talking about? A fucking Houdini? Marino is angry and foul because he's unnerved, and his eyes are everywhere, his right hand down by the holstered 40-caliber Glock on his hip. My biggest concern is that someone else might be dead. Gloves and face shield off, and I place my packages inside a steel evidence locker, shut the door, and scan my thumb to set the biometric lock. If the stains and fletching are what I think they are, then we have another problem. Where did this biological material come from? Who or what did it come from? Could it be from her? He means Chanel Gilbert. She's not missing any of her scalp, and her hair isn't short and dyed light blonde. If what I'm seeing is human blood and tissue, they won't be hers. I'm sure of that, and I go on to tell him I feel set up. I push two black plastic scene cases closer to him, and they scrape over the diamond plate steel floor. I explain it would be tough to prove I didn't place the arrow in here myself. I witnessed you finding it. I know you didn't put it there. Marino lifts the cases and sets them on the flooded driveway. You really can't know that for a fact. It was inside my truck, I repeat, and I'm going to have to tell him about the videos because now the stakes have changed. Carrie has just made her presence known. That transforms everything instantly and completely. But I certainly didn't put a copper arrow in here. I've never seen it before. I promise you that, I'm saying to Marino. I witnessed you take photographs, and they'll have a date and time stamp. You've got proof that it was already inside the truck, that you found it because it started making noise. Say what you want. Whether I have proof or not, I'm being set up. This is deliberate, I repeat, as he takes the truck keys from me. Lucy feels set up, and now I do, I add, and I'm going to have to tell him the truth, the whole truth. All of us are being set up, and we'd better think long and hard and in different ways about everything we do, starting right this minute. He begins a slow walk around the truck while I wait inside the back of it and think about how he'll react to what I confess. He'll say I should have told him hours ago. He'll say I shouldn't have watched the videos unless he was watching them with me, and I hear him checking every access door, unlocking each and banging it shut in the relentless rain. I argue with myself that it doesn't matter how he'll feel or react, because in light of what's happening, it would be irresponsible not to tell him, and I wait for him to return to the open tailgate. When he does, he announces that every panel, every storage compartment is locked with no sign of tampering. Then I start in with him. Marino, I need you to listen carefully. You won't like what you're about to hear me say. What? He's getting more out of sorts, and if this is a mistake, there's no going back. I really don't know what else to do. And that's the vortex we're caught in, and it's precisely where Carrie has put us and wants us to stay. Our usual habits, protocols, and procedures for handling the smallest tasks get turned inside out, upside down, and are shattered and sucked away into another dimension. She's done it before. She's doing it again. And I remember what my boss, General John Briggs, the Chief of Armed Forces Medical Examiners, often preaches. When terrorists find something that works, they keep on doing it. It's predictable. Carrie Grethen is a terrorist. She's doing what she knows works, creating havoc and confusion. Until we lose direction and judgment, until we hurt ourselves and each other. Think. We're going to have to make things up as we go along, I tell Marino. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. Think about what she'd predict you'd do right now. The usual way we do things isn't necessarily relevant and workable, and we're going to have to be flexible and extremely attentive, as if we're starting out all over, as if we're having to recreate the wheel, because we are in a sense. She knows our playbook, Marino. She knows our cookbook. She knows every handbook we've ever read for everything we do. We have to be open to change and mindful of any assumptions she might make based on her knowing us so well. She assumes you won't tell anyone. I wasn't going to tell you, but now I've changed my mind, because to keep it a secret is what I anticipate she expects me to do. I've been sent 3 video clips so far today. I speak loudly, slowly, and in a calm manner that belies what churns inside of me. Surveillance recordings taken by Carrie, it would seem. Apparently, they were filmed covertly in Lucy's dorm room when she was at Quantico in 1997. Carrie sent you videos that are 17 years old? Marino is incredulous and enraged. Are you sure they aren't faked? They weren't. What do you mean they weren't? As in the past tense. Let me see them. I can't. That's what I mean by past tense. The instant I finished watching them, they were gone, and the links were dead. Then the messages themselves disappeared as if I never got them. Emailed? Marino's wet face is pale and stony, his bloodshot eyes glaring. Texted. Supposedly from Lucy's in case of emergency cell phone line. That figures. That sucks. The FBI has her phone. They'll see what she sent. They'll think she sent the videos to you. It will be more of the same, her getting blamed for what Carrie does. Let's hope nothing shows up. It shouldn't, because I'm fairly certain Carrie is spoofing the ICE line. The texts aren't really from Lucy or any device she owns. You should give me your phone. Marino holds out his hand. I need to take out the SIM card and the battery if you want any proof you ever got what you're saying. We need to be able to show Lucy had nothing to do with it. No. Your SIM card may be the only record you've got. No. The longer you wait, I'm not disabling my phone, I interrupt him. If I do that, I can't see anything else she decides to send. Do you hear yourself? The video links are the real reason I rushed out of here this morning. I was afraid Carrie had Lucy's phone, and what it would mean if it were true. I have to keep my phone. Marino bends over to look at something below me at the back of the truck. He's interested in a taillight. When I tell you more about the videos, you'll understand my concern, I continue to explain, and Lucy wasn't answering when I tried to reach her. Janet wasn't either. Now we know it was because the FBI was herding them around and seizing their possessions. What is it? What have you found? Marino has gotten interested in one of the truck's white high-intensity LEDs. Shit, he says in an ominous tone. I don't believe it. Now what? Right under our nose. What they mean by in plain view. He hovers over the left taillight, his hands clasped behind his back, the way he does when he wants to make sure he doesn't touch something. Can you hand me some clean gloves? I snatch a pair out of the box for him. I stick my head out of the back of the truck to see what he's found as I'm battered by heavy rain. It runs down my face and the back of my neck as I count the screws missing from the left taillight's chrome mount. 5 are gone. The one that remains is scratched and gouged. Chapter 31. Thunderclaps. Water hisses and splashes around his big black leather sneakers. Marino talks on his phone to Al Jax, or Ajax as he's called. I piece together the gist of what the former Navy SEAL is asking about the house itself. He wants to know what makes Marino think someone could be inside. Is there any chance Hyde is in there? Maybe he's injured or a hostage? I watch all this from the back of the truck as Marino formally requests the assistance of SWAT, his earpiece flashing blue in the wet din. I'm well aware of the risk he's taking. If a special ops team rolls out on this high-profile property, it will be extremely embarrassing and difficult to justify if it's discovered there was no need. Furthermore, such a dramatic display will be one more thing to explain to Chanel Gilbert's wealthy Hollywood mother. She's already going to be a force to reckon with. I'm sure of that. The rear lens assembly is fashioned with stainless number one size Phillips screws, but it looks like someone used a regular or number two size screwdriver, Marino describes over the phone as he looks at the damaged left taillight. Or maybe a knife, or who knows what, because of the one screw left. The head's all buggered up like someone used the wrong tool. I imagine Carrie Grethen. Would she use the wrong tool? It doesn't sound like her. But who else would leave me such a grisly gift, and what's the rest of the story? I realize it's not likely, but yeah, I think we have to entertain the possibility he could be inside. Marino is talking on the phone about Hyde again as he stares at the dark, silent house. But how would he have gotten in on his own? I didn't leave him a key. And if he's incapacitated inside, for example, what happened to his car? Yeah, exactly. That's all I'm asking. Let's clear the house, but we do it on the lowdown. I want to be real careful what goes out over the air. I don't want a freaking carnival at a multi-million-dollar house by the Harvard campus. Marino tells him to bring several sets of dry clothes, and he describes my size as men's medium before I can tell him that will be a tent on me. He ends that call and makes another one. I realize he's talking to his contact at the phone company, probably the same technical operations manager he always gets hold of when he needs a warrant or wishes to bypass waiting for one. Marino recites two cell phone numbers that I assume belong to Hyde and Lappin. He wants to ping locations. Then we wait. It's going to take 15 or 20 minutes before we know anything, Doc. Marino struggles to pull gloves over his wet hands. And I already feel like crap. I hope like hell I didn't just make a bad mistake. It's kind of like nothing we do this minute is right. If we leave, it's wrong. If we stay out here on the driveway, it's wrong. If we go inside the house, it's wrong. If we ask for help, it's wrong. And if we don't, it's wrong. There's not a damn thing we can do that even makes sense, except to wait for Ajax and his guys to roll up. He removes the taillight mount and sets it on the bumper. And I'm aware of how isolated and vulnerable we are. If someone wanted to take us out, it would already have happened. If Carrie wanted to kill us this very second, she would. I've never really believed we could stop her. When we thought she died years ago, we didn't feel responsible or give ourselves the credit. We simply felt lucky. We felt blessed. Holy shit, Marino says. The bulb's missing. And behind where it was screwed in is a decent-sized wire routing hole that I'm guessing the arrow was shoved through. That would put it exactly where you found it on the floor inside the desk cabinet. I've been driving around with a taillight out? Well, that verifies that the truck couldn't have been like this for very long. Exactly. The question is, when was the damage done? Because someone couldn't have removed the screws, the bulb, while the truck was parked on Lucy's driveway. Unless the FBI did it. Planting evidence, tampering with state and federal property? Let's hope the FBI wouldn't be that unethical or stupid. I crouch on the shiny steel floor near the open cabinet where I found the arrow, as I remember what Lucy said about Carrie's obsession with invisibility technology. I look around as if she's ubiquitous and transparent like air.
and the wind buffets the truck, and rain thrums it in varying intensities, beating, then thrashing, then pouring. And Marino is hunched against the weather, while I'm spared for the moment. I shine the flashlight inside the cabinet, painting the intense beam over the routing hole, over stacks of cheap blue towels tied with string, the steel floor mirror bright in the light. I notice something else. The clump of dust is what people often refer to as a dust bunny or dust ball. It's about the size of a martini olive, fluffy like lint from the dryer. Another pair of clean gloves, and I use the adhesive back of a Post-it to collect a sample of what I'm sure will prove a treasure trove, a microscopic landfill of debris. Fibers, hairs, insect pieces and parts, and particulates that could be anything I imagine. But I'm certain the origin can't be one of my CFC trucks. It can't be the labs or the parking lot surrounded by its high black fence that's supposed to be impossible to climb. Next, I seal the dust bunny inside a plastic bag, and it goes into the same locker where I place the arrow and the metamaterial. I call my chief of staff. For an entire minute, Bryce and I have a useless conversation about chain of evidence, and I don't have the patience for his incessant chatter. I continue interrupting him. The CFC isn't even 10 minutes from here, and I want the truck swapped out immediately for an SUV. Get Harold or Rusty to take care of it right away. I apologize about the inconvenience, but I need this truck out of here now. The chain of evidence must be preserved. Not just the evidence packaged inside, but also the truck itself. I don't understand. Bryce has said this several times. Because, like you just pointed out, you're 10 minutes from here. You sure you and Marino can't drop it off yourselves when you're done, Dr. Scarpetta? I mean, you're coming here anyway. I'm not trying to be a pain, but we're kind of up to our eyeballs. We've had quite the full house this morning with you not here, and Luke's only just now starting his third case, while Harold and Rusty clean workstations and suture up bodies for the other docs. And two of them decided to pull out that box from the skeleton closet, so to speak. Remember the one from the other week, Bryce? The remains that washed up on Revere Beach? The anthropologist just got the DNA results, and it's for sure the girl who vanished from her houseboat near the aquarium last year. They have the bones all spread out like a jigsaw puzzle, and Bryce, please be quiet and listen. It appears the truck has been vandalized. I want it to go straight into the evidence bay for processing, and I have additional evidence in a locker that needs to go to the labs ASAP. I give him a list of what I want the scientists to look for first. There appears to be biological materials, such as blood and tissue, and I want DNA as fast as we can get it, I add, as I stand inside the truck, and Marino is hunched against the relentless rain, like Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh. And trace evidence because I'm seeing dirt, fibers, and an unknown material that looks like quartz, plus tool marks on a screw. Quartz and a screw? Oh my God, that sounds exciting. Let's get Ernie on it right away. Ernie Koppel is my senior trace evidence examiner. He's a superb microscopist, one of the best. Texting him as we speak, Bryce says in my earpiece. And BTW? What's all that racket in the background? It sounds like someone is beating an oil drum with a stick. Have you looked out your window? A pause. And I imagine him looking, then his surprised voice. Well, hello! The acoustics are so amazing in this building. I couldn't hear an earthquake, and then I had my blinds closed because it's so depressing out, and whoops, I forgot we're having a flood. And I'm sending a note to Jen now about swapping out the truck if that's all right with you. It isn't really. Jen Garrett is the forensic investigator I hired last year after Marino walked off the job at the CFC and signed on with the Cambridge Police Department. She can't begin to take his place and never will. She wasn't a good choice with her tight clothes and bling and insatiable craving for attention. I can't stomach her flirting and flippancy. I've been meaning to begin the process of letting her go, but the summer has raced away from me. All right,
I concede to Bryce. Tell her a response team is headed here as we speak, and she's not to interfere or get in the way of their vehicle. A response team, as in SWAT? Please just listen, Bryce. I'll pull my truck over as far as I can so she can go around it and park the SUV in front of it. Then she can get out, and so can I. She's not to come inside the house. She's to call me the instant she arrives, and I'll meet her at the kitchen door, and we'll exchange keys. Got it. I've just told her to head toward you in one of those amphibious boats they use for the duck tours, and I'm kidding. He doesn't seem to breathe while he talks incessantly. But it's so unfair. I just had everything washed the other day. Our entire fleet was all shiny and white and perfect, and now this? Yes, you do a great job keeping our vehicles clean, which is exactly why I'm fairly sure the dust sample I collected came from somewhere else and was transferred to the inside of the truck. It's important to tell Ernie that. I love dust bunnies. Bryce says it as if he's talking about his favorite pet. Well, I mean as long as they're not inside my house, but they wouldn't be. Anyway, who knows what story your little dust bunny will have to tell. Hair, fur, skin cells, fibers, and all sorts of ticky-tacky frickin'-frack that people track in and out of everywhere. I ask him to explain to Ernie that an unusual projectile, an arrow, was also left inside the truck. And under a lens, I can see dirt, debris, and glue. It's on the arrow, and possibly in the dust bunny. And if so, that suggests they may have come from the same source, I add. They may have been in the same location at some point. We should be able to tell microscopically and by using X-ray spectroscopy to give us chemical and elemental information as well. Got it. I'll explain it to Ernie word for word. I know Anne's already sent him something. Well, she didn't send it, per se, since we're on the subject of chain of evidence. She did it the right way, walked it up there, and receipted it, etc., etc., so if anyone tries to nail her in court, all to say we're holding down the ship here. My compulsive talking chief of staff, for whom so much ends in question marks, is well known for his malapropisms. I have a diplomatic way of correcting him that he never notices. I simply repeat what he said and do a word substitution or two. I appreciate your holding down the fort, I say to him. While you're at it, I'd like the CFC security recordings checked for anybody who might have been in our parking lot, tampering with the truck or anything else. But how would they get over the fence or through the gate? Good question. But where else would the tampering have been done? What day did you say the vehicles were washed and detailed? Let me think. Today's Friday, so day before yesterday, Wednesday. I think we can safely conclude that the damage was done during or after the truck was washed. Otherwise, a chrome mount, barely attached by one screw, would have been noticed. What did Anne receipt to Ernie? Did she find something important? I can't wait to dash to his lab and ask. I end the call and say to Marino, we don't get dust bunnies inside our trucks. I climb out, and it's like walking into a waterfall. You know better than anybody how meticulously we wash and decon them inside and out. It's not possible for dust bunnies, dust balls, cobwebs, or any such thing to form inside any of our vehicles. What the hell are you talking about? He asks, and the taillights, chrome mount, gasket, outer lens, foam seal, and housing are all the way off, but still connected to the pigtail harness. Did you hear what I just told Bryce? I can't hear a damn thing out here. I feel like I'm in a washing machine. This definitely has been messed with, and for the obvious reason of planting something inside the truck. So the person had to have mechanical know-how and be familiar with trucks like this, or specifically with this one. It's as if I'm standing under a shower. That's what I'm thinking. When you want a big transport vehicle that you can use as a mobile office and command post, it's always going to be 4410. He refers to the last four numbers of the truck's license tag. Assuming it's available for deployment and in good repair with plenty of gas, anyone who knows much about you knows that your first choice is 4410 if you're driving yourself to a complicated scene. And I specifically requested this truck this morning
because I knew Chanel Gilbert would be an involved, time-consuming case. Even if it was nothing more than a random accident, we have a bloody scene with a lot of questions. We have a high-profile victim and a high-profile neighborhood in Cambridge. We have potential political complications. It was a safe bet that this was the vehicle to tamper with, Marino says. And I step closer to him. I'm up to my bootlaces in a puddle as I examine the rectangular outline on the white metal chassis where the mount was attached. I look at the hole with the plastic-coated wires threaded through it. And he's right. The arrow would have fit with room to spare. If this is the point of entry, and I believe it is, I decide. That's important, because it suggests that whoever is responsible—
We know who!
Marino blurts it out. Why not just act like we know it's her? Who else would it be? I'm trying to be objective. Don't bother. What I was about to say is she didn't necessarily access the inside of the truck, so she didn't need a key. Exactly. What she did was remove the lens and the entire housing, exposing the hole in the cab and the grommet the wiring runs through, he explains. Now you have a breach, a way to get something inside the truck without opening it up. That made it a cinch when it was time to drop the arrow in. All she had to do was move the housing, swivel it to one side until the hole was exposed, drop the arrow in, and straighten the mount again. He demonstrates. It would take all of 3 seconds. And this was done while we were parked on Lucy's driveway. I'm thinking the taillight was sabotaged earlier, maybe when the truck was in the CFC parking lot, but I doubt the arrow was put in there at the same time, or we would have heard it rolling around. We've been riding in this damn thing since we met at your office early this morning. We didn't hear anything clanking until we headed back here a few minutes ago. You want to package this now? I ask. Marino says yes. There will be tool marks. We should have Ernie make comparisons of them with ones we found on other gifts from Carrie. Copper bullets, cartridge cases, pennies she polished in a tumbler and left in my yard on my birthday, June 12th. The spears she shot the police divers and me with 3 days later. I climb back up on the tailgate, back into the truck. I put on clean gloves, and Marino hands the taillight components to me. I tear off more sections of white butcher paper from the roll on a counter as I drip water on the floor. You probably wouldn't notice there's only one screw left unless you thought to look. He talks loudly as I begin rapping. But the mount would have come off soon enough if you hit a bad enough bump or pothole. Jesus! He looks up at the swirling dark sky, at the blowing sheets of water spattering his face. This is the kind of weather chickens drown in!
Chapter 32. I slam shut the double doors and relock them. I look around the rain-swept property as I walk through the downpour to the cab of the truck. In the distance, cars move slowly along Brattle Street. Their headlights burn through the fog. I watch for the tactical team. It will be here any minute, but everything seems like an endless wait as hard rain boils on brick. The wind shrieks and groans around the house and through the trees as if we've violated a spirit world, and Marino and I climb back into the truck's cab. Both of us are so drenched it no longer matters, and I'm not reassured because a backup is on the way. I don't feel safe. I don't care who or what is on the way, the patrol units or SWAT. Nothing would give me peace of mind right now because we don't seem to be in charge. We're not the ones making choices. Even when we think something is our idea, we discover maybe it's not. We're being outmaneuvered and outsmarted, and Marino is feeling the same way. Since I told him about the videos, he's accepted that when we got up this morning, we didn't know the day belonged to Carrie Grethen. But it does, and she must be getting high on her diabolical drama. How's this for screwed up? Marino says, as we shut our doors and the downpour beats the metal roof. We can't go anywhere, including inside the house.
We can't wait out on the driveway unless we want to drown or be a sitting duck. So we're stuck inside your damn truck. We've been stuck inside your truck the whole damn day. I feel we're going to be stuck inside it the rest of our lives.
She must have placed the arrow inside before the storm hit. With the FBI right there?
I'm not interested in hearing him complain. I'm interested in how what I just suggested is possible. What did she do? Is she invisible? Is it what Lucy suggested, and Carrie has new tricks she's learned since she almost murdered me in Florida?
Exactly, with the friggin' FBI right there.
Marino lights a cigarette, and I crank the engine so he can open his window a little.
But no one could do that on Lucy's property without being picked up by the cameras.
I'm not sure that's true, if one knew exactly where the cameras are and how much they cover, or if the person has a way of hacking into the system and foiling it somehow. Or maybe there's some other explanation. I think of the metamaterial again.
Well, I guess the way you parked might have partially blocked the view of the back of the truck because that asshole FBI agent's SUV was in the way, Marino says. But we'll have to ask Lucy and see if she can help us. Or Janet.
Supposedly, yesterday and today, the motion sensors detected something, but the cameras didn't, I inform him. Lucy says this was at around 4 o'clock both mornings.
Maybe a squirrel, a rabbit, something low to the ground.
He flicks an ash out the top of the window. That wouldn't set off the motion sensors. Something was there, but wasn't. She says she can't figure it out.
I never believe it when Lucy says she can't figure something out. Erin Loria should know if anything's been picked up by the cameras. I'm sure she may know quite a lot.
I feel a rush of hostility and realize how much I resent and blame her.
You can bet she's been watching the monitors and looking at the recordings, he says, as I turn on the defog and wipers to clear the glass. Maybe she saw something that could help us.
I'm not asking her a damn thing. I wonder how much he remembers from Lucy's FBI Academy days, and I prod him. At one point, she was a new agent in Lucy's dorm, I remind him. Washington dorm, and they were on the same floor.
When I saw her this morning, she wasn't familiar, and I'm also not sure why I would have run into her back then, he says. The only time I really came to Quantico was if we were working a case or I was meeting you. Why would I have known Erin Loria?
You wouldn't have, necessarily. But based on what I saw in the videos, she may have been romantically involved with Carrie. I go on to say that Carrie and Lucy had one of their worst fights and may have broken up because of the former beauty queen from Tennessee who has just raided Lucy's property and is now married to a federal judge.
Agents climbing all over the place, and with the chopper up.
Marino is busy picking off dirt and bits of wet grass and leaves stuck to his bare, wet lower legs.
And we were walking around, too. And she puts a possible murder weapon inside your crime scene truck?
He's not talking about Erin Loria anymore. He's talking about Carrie.
What for? To help us out? To help us work some other scene we don't even know about yet?
Even if she figured that I might be driving this today, we have to ask what scene she might have known about in advance. I shove the gear shifts into reverse and check my mirrors. And I'm voting for this one. I back up and pull forward, maneuvering as far off the driveway as I can without running over shrubs or hitting trees. I suggest we should consider that she has planned and concocted everything we're experiencing, including the homicide scene we're on right now. She knew I'd respond to it personally and which vehicle I'd choose. I'm in town, I continue to explain. Anybody watching me would know that I'm not traveling. I'm here. I'm back to working cases like usual, and that wouldn't have been true even a couple of weeks ago.
She'd know all that if she's hacked into the CFC computer.
Lucy says she hasn't.
I don't care what Lucy says. That doesn't mean it's true. Not when you consider who we're talking about.
If the CFC database has been hacked and the hacker is Carrie,
I reply. Then yes, she could know everything about where I am and when and why.
Your calendar. Everything is electronic.
That's right. But Lucy says the CFC database is safe. I check the mirrors and am startled by the blacked-out Suburban with glass tinted as dark as Darth Vader. It seems the ominous SUV has appeared out of nowhere and is parked behind us with no lights or siren on. Its engine is drowned out by the storm and the diesel rumble of my truck.
I'm gonna have to let them in the house, and you need to stay put, Marino says to me as the Suburban's doors open simultaneously.
He opens his door and holds the cigarette out in the rain to extinguish it. He drops the wet butt into the water bottle.
I'm not sitting here by myself.
I open my door, too. I'm not staying out here alone while you're inside.
No wandering off anywhere, Marino says.
He climbs out to greet four SWAT operators in full tactical gear. Their binocular night vision goggles are flipped up from battlewear helmets. Slung across their chests are M4 assault rifles fitted with green lasers that are visible only in the infrared spectral range of light.
Stick with me at all times, Marino tosses back at me.
The team leader, nicknamed Ajax, is young and massively built. He's attractive in a scary way, square-jawed with cool gray eyes and short dark hair. I recognize the roundish patch on his right cheek, a healed penetrating wound possibly from frag or bullet. He hardly looks at me as he hands Marino a black trash bag that has something thick inside it. There are none of the usual quips, none of the typical teasing and banter. No one is smiling, and the plan is simple. His team will clear the house, making sure it's safe while we hang back. This should take 15 minutes, depending on what they find, and we follow them to the entrance. We step over the single ribbon of yellow crime scene tape, and on the front porch, Marino digs into a pocket for a key tagged as evidence. The security system begins to beep the instant he opens the door.
That's good, at least, he comments, as the foul odor welcomes us back. It doesn't appear someone entered the house since we were last here, unless the person has the alarm code.
He shuts the front door behind us, and it echoes solidly in a cool stillness punctuated by the tick-tock of clocks. The four officers are nimble and light on their booted feet as they head down the central hallway and up the staircase, spreading out in pairs with weapons tucked in close and at the ready, leaving Marino and me alone. He sets down our scene cases. He opens the black plastic trash bag. He slides out folded tactical clothing that he stacks on the floor. Water slowly drips. Puddles begin to form around my sopping wet boots as I hover near the shut door. When we were here this morning, I didn't hear the clocks. Tick-tock, tick-tock. I scan the upright stepladder. The dark, dried blood we mapped with orange evidence flags that flutter slightly in chilled air blowing through vents. I listen to the dull patter of rain on the slate roof. I'm keenly aware of the clocks. Tick-tock, tick-tock. They're loud and disconcerting. I scan the shards of glass from the light bulbs and antique crystal fixture we're supposed to believe Chanel Gilbert broke when she lost her balance and fell. That's what we're meant to accept. Or is it really? Are we supposed to be tricked? Are we supposed to figure out that we're being tricked? Possibly the answer is both. It's all of the above and nothing, and I look up at the silver base of the chandelier with its two empty light sockets. I'm reminded of the bulb missing from my truck's taillight. I'm reminded of Carrie. It's as if I've been infected by her. As if she's taken over my life, and my pulse kicks up another notch. I listen to the clocks. Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. Glassy splinters glitter, and the spooky blue glow of the reagent I sprayed this morning has faded entirely. The area of white marble is blank again, as if nothing is there. Marino turned on the air conditioning before we left this morning, and I'm cold on the way to shivering in my soaking wet clothes. I begin to pace, and almost don't recognize myself in the Baroque mirror to the right of the front door. I look at the woman looking back at me in the corroded silver glass in its chipped gilt frame of acanthus sleeves. I stare at my reflection as if it's someone I don't know. My short blonde hair dripping wet and plastered to my head, making my strong features seem more pronounced and dominant than I imagine them. My eyes are a deeper blue, a bruised blue that hints of my dark, intense mood, and I can see the tension in muscles of my forehead and around my firmly set mouth. My navy blue field clothes with their embroidered CFC crest are dripping wet and clinging to me. I look like a waif, like an apparition, and I move away from the mirror. My attention wanders past the staircase and into the living room, and I see what Marino meant when he was talking about Chanel Gilbert or someone having unusual interests. On both sides of a deep stone fireplace are antique spinning wheels, three-legged with wooden seats, and I spot another one next to the couch. I notice the hourglasses and thick candles on the mantel and tables, and I count the clocks. At least six of them. Wall clocks, tall case clocks, shelf clocks. From where I stand near the door, I can see that their pale moon faces and ornate hands all show the same time of 1:20. "Did you notice the clocks this morning?" I ask Marino as I listen for other sounds in the house. I don't hear the tactical team. The men are so quiet, it's as if they aren't here. All I detect is blowing air and the clocks. Tick-tock, tick-tock. "Did you notice them?" I persist, because I didn't, and I would have. "I don't remember, but there was a lot going on." Marino has stationed himself between the staircase and the door under it that leads down into the cellar. "I'm quite certain I would have noticed. I'm surprised you didn't." Marino's answer is to look up at the ceiling, his head cocked as he listens, his right hand by his gun. I can tell he's thinking what I am. Ajax and his team are quiet. They're too quiet. If something has happened, we'll be next. I feel a certain resignation about it, a deeply stored feeling I don't pull out and look at often. But it's there. It's familiar. It's not an acutely sad or unpleasant feeling, but more of an acquiescence, a tacit consent that I can hold fate in my hands like a skull and unflinchingly look it in the eye. You can't destroy me if I don't care. This day could be our last, and if it's in the cards, then so be it. I'll prevent any bad thing I can. That's my life's mission. I also know how to accept finality, to give myself up to what I can't begin to change. I don't want to die, but I refuse to fear it. I wait for it without dread, because there's no logic in living a tragedy before it's happened. "Truth is," Marino says as I wait and listen, "I don't remember hearing any clocks, but I saw them when I walked through. I'm pretty sure they all told a different time," he explains, and my expectation intensifies as I wait for what's about to happen.